about the theory of quasi-categories, and the reason was, in this world of derived algebraic geometry, everything is really higher categorical in nature. That is, if you have any pair of objects that we're considering, maybe they're E-infinity rings, or they're sort of schemes made out of E-infinity rings, well, maps between them really form a space or a homotopy type rather than just an ordinary set. And in order to get a reasonable theory, we need to take that into account more or less everywhere. So the theory of quasi-categories is one formalism, a very convenient one, for doing that sort of thing. And I don't want to really say any more about it, because I'd like to get to some other things in these lectures, but just keep in mind that really some sort of formalism for doing higher category theory is going to have to be in the background for everything that I'm going to say in the future. So, for example, wherever I say category, I probably really mean something like a quasi-category. Okay. So what I'd like to do today is talk about an application of this formalism of derived algebraic geometry to constructing equivariant cohomology theories. But before I get there, I need to say something which I meant to fit into Wednesday's lecture last week. And that's to talk about quasi-coherent sheaves on derived schemes. So, suppose that X is a derived scheme, or more properly, maybe I should say X, OX is a derived scheme. So X is a topological space, and OX is a sheaf of E-infinity rings on X. Well, first, maybe I should make a remark. If A is an E-infinity ring, then there exists a good theory of A modules, or A module spectra. So an A module spectrum, something I'll denote by a letter like M, well, just as in the usual theory of modules, it's something which is equipped with some sort of a bilinear map from A tensor M into M. So I'll write this as a tensor product, or maybe the more usual homotopy theoretic notation is to write this as a smash product of spectra. So it's something like a spectrum is sort of the homotopy theoretic analog of an abelian group, and this is the homotopy theoretic analog of, say, an abelian group that has an action of a ring A. And so let me just make a few remarks about this notion. If M is an A-module spectrum, then the homotopy groups of M, which, like the homotopy groups of A, are things that live in both positive and negative degrees, these homotopy groups form a module over the homotopy groups of A. So in particular, each pi n of M is a pi naught of A module. All right. So now, this is sort of modules. Now we want to talk about sheaves of modules. So if XOX is a derived scheme, we can talk about OX modules on X. Namely, these are sheaves, let's say script M, such that script M of U is an OX of U module spectrum for all U. So the typical example of the kinds of sheaves of modules that we'll encounter, well, suppose that X is spec A, where A is an E-infinity ring, and suppose that M is an A-module, then you can define an associated sheaf of modules on spec A. Let me call this M twiddle. So M twiddle on one of these basic open sets U sub F. So remember, U sub F is the set of prime ideals not containing a given element F contained in spec A, where F is an element in pi naught of A. So on U sub F, this is just supposed to be M adjoint F inverse, which a couple of ways that you could define this, but just the quickest, maybe I take the module M and tensor it over A with the thing that I called A adjoint F inverse that we were talking about last time. So this turns out to be a well-defined prescription, and there is a sheaf of OX module spectra satisfying this prescription. And now, definition, a sheaf of OX module on X is quasi-coherent if the pair X OX, let me call this sheaf M, X OX M looks locally like spec A O spec A M twiddle, where A is an E infinity ring and M is an A module. So this is just mimicking the usual definition in ordinary algebraic geometry. And as in ordinary algebraic geometry, this is not just true very locally, but in fact, provided that X is a derived scheme, if this condition is true on, you know, sufficiently small open sets, then it's actually true on any affine open set. For any time you can make X look like spec A, this sheaf of modules, script M, actually looks like M twiddle for some uniquely determined A module M. And now just a warning. If X is an ordinary scheme, a quasi-coherent sheaf on X in this sense is not just an ordinary quasi-coherent sheaf. Say, if X is spec A, where A is an ordinary commutative ring, well, here we're talking about A module spectra and not just discrete A modules. So the effect of that is that instead we get a derived category of the usual quasi-coherent sheaf. And that's literally true if, say, X is nice, something, say, a quasi-compact separated scheme, then actually this category of quasi-coherent sheaves, say, the homotopy category of quasi-coherent sheaves of spectra on X, that literally is just the derived category in the sense of usual homological algebra of the ordinary sheaf. The abelian category of quasi-coherent sheaves in the ordinary sense. So that is one of the motivations for calling this derived algebraic geometry. Derived is supposed to make you think of derived categories, because derived categories are the kinds of derived categories of the usual things that appear in algebraic geometry are what actually appear when you work with these sorts of things. Okay, so this is, I just wanted to quickly introduce this notion of a quasi-coherent sheaf because it's going to be important for the constructions that I'm going to be doing later in this lecture. Okay, so now I'd like to change gears and talk about a new problem. So, let A be a cohomology theory, and now I want to consider the question of constructing or construct what I'll call equivariant versions of A. So what does this mean? Well, A is a cohomology theory, so more or less by definition, it's something that we plug in topological spaces to. So if X is a topological space, we can ask about the A cohomology of X, say, in various degrees, and we get groups. So these are abelian groups, or maybe they have some more structure. If this is a multiplicative cohomology theory, there's some kind of a ring structure there, something like that. Equivariant versions of A, well, what you want is, imagine now that you have not a topological space X alone, but you also you have a compact Lie group G, and G is acting continuously on X. And you want, say, to be able to talk about the G equivariant A cohomology of X. So the typical example, and the one that we're going to be discussing most often today, is the case where A is complex K-theory. So the complex K-theory in degree 0 for X, say, a nice space, well, that's given, as I mentioned last time, by taking the Grothendieck group of isomorphism classes of complex vector bundles on X. Now, if you have a compact Lie group acting on X, well, then you can consider not arbitrary complex vector bundles on X, but only complex vector bundles on X that are equipped with a compatible action of the group G. And you get a variation on this construction, which is the usual G equivariant K theory. Now, G equivariant K theory and ordinary K theory are related. And more generally, to give a G equivariant version of A, well, we want some relationship between these G equivariant cohomology groups and the ordinary A cohomology groups. And that relationship should be that if G acts freely on X, you want the G equivariant cohomology of X to just recover the ordinary cohomology of the quotient X modulo G. So, an example, trivial way to satisfy this, or naive way to achieve this, is by the so-called Borel construction. That is, we know what we're supposed to do in view of this equivalence. We know what we're supposed to do when G acts freely on X. So if G doesn't act freely on X, well, we'll just adjust the situation ever so slightly to make G, put ourselves in a situation where G does act freely on X. So if we have any cohomology theory A, we can define the Borel equivariant G cohomology of X. This is by definition going to be, well, the Borel equivariant cohomology, G equivariant cohomology of X cross EG. So here, EG is some contractible space on which G is acting freely. So you choose a contractible space on which G acts freely, you multiply X by it. Well, you haven't changed the homotopy type of this product because EG was contractible, but on the other hand, you have made G act freely. And This is just the ordinary A cohomology of the quotient x cross eg modulo the diagonal action of g. This is called the Borel construction. And it gives an equivariant version of the cohomology theory A, but in some sense not a very interesting one, because of course what we've done here is just invent a fancy new notation for ordinary A cohomology. And in particular, it may or may not be the equivariant version of the cohomology theory A that we are looking for. So for example, in the case where A is complex K-theory, equivariant complex K-theory, defined by thinking about equivariant vector bundles, is not given by this Borel construction. So I'd like to see that in the simple example. So if I think about the G equivariant K-theory of a point, well, this is given by thinking about G equivariant vector bundles on a point, or in other words, just representations of G. So this is just the complex representation ring of the group G. On the other hand, the Borel G equivariant K-theory of a point, this is the K-theory of the quotient EG modulo G, or what's called the classifying space of G. And these are typically not the same. There's a natural map from here to here. If you have any representation of G, you can make a complex vector bundle on the classifying space by a sort of associated bundle construction. But this map is never an isomorphism unless G is trivial. But it's not too far off. So according to the theorem, the Atiyah-Siegel completion theorem, the K-theory of BG is a completion of the representation ring of G. That is, this map is not going to be an isomorphism, but it exhibits the bottom as some sort of completion of the top. So let me spell this out in the simplest example. So an example of the example, let G be the circle group S1. So then the representation ring of G, well, G is a compact, so every representation is a sum of irreducibles. It's abelian, so all of those irreducibles are one-dimensional. They're given by characters of G, and all of the characters of G are just integral powers of the defining character, where we identify the circle with the unit complex numbers. So this representation ring is just a Laurent polynomial ring in one variable, where the variable u corresponds to the one-dimensional representation where g is acting by rotations. On the other hand, the classifying space of the K-theory of BG, the classifying space of g in this case, is infinite-dimensional complex projective space, CP infinity. Well, this turns out, by some calculation, just to be a power series ring in one variable over the integers. And this map from here to here is given by sending u to 1 plus t. So you can either compute this directly, or you can say this is an application of the Atiyah-Siegel theorem. So the Atiyah-Siegel theorem tells you that the right-hand side here is supposed to be some kind of completion of the left-hand side. It's the completion with respect to its augmentation ideal, or the ideal consisting of representations which have virtual dimension zero. So here, u and its inverse are one-dimensional representations. The augmentation ideal is generated by u minus 1, which is a typical example of a representation of virtual dimension zero. So instead I could say here, u minus 1 goes to t, and when you complete with respect to the ideal generated by u minus 1, what you get is just arbitrary power series in u minus 1. That's what this is saying. All right, so now let's be algebraic geometers and try and recognize these rings. So an algebraic geometer will recognize this is the ring of functions on the algebraic group GM over spec Z. And this ring here is given by completing this ring of functions near a point of GM. So here's a picture of GM. GM is all invertible numbers. So this is one-dimensional affine space, and here I've cut out the origin. The identity element, we're completing with respect to u minus 1, u being the natural coordinate here. So here's u equals 1. And when we complete with respect to this point, what we get is the ring of functions on some very small formal neighborhood of this point u equals 1. So this here is the ring of functions on what's called the formal multiplicative group, GM hat, or the formal spectrum of this ring, Z adjoined T. And now this map here has a natural geometric interpretation. It takes functions which are defined on the entire multiplicative group and restricts them to this formal neighborhood of the identity. So it takes the germ near the point u equals 1. So now, the moral of this picture and what I'd like to spend today's lecture generalizing is this idea that certain equivariant cohomology theories sort of have some algebraic geometry associated with them. That is, here, equivariant K-theory has something to do with the multiplicative group, and your naive guess at what you might define equivariant K-theory to be, what's given by the Borel construction, has some geometry associated with it, but less geometry. Here you're getting the formal multiplicative group. So equivariant K-theory, promoting, say, Borel equivariant K-theory, which is really determined just by ordinary K-theory, to the usual equivariant K-theory, which is something new, in geometric terms, that's related to taking this formal multiplicative group, which is just a very small neighborhood of the identity, and realizing that that is the very small neighborhood of the identity in some larger group, in this case, the entire multiplicative group. Okay, so this is the picture that I would like to generalize. So for this lecture, our goal is going to be to start with some data. And so our data, first of all, is going to be a cohomology theory A. A plus some geometry. And we would like to, from this data, produce equivariant versions of the cohomology theory A. So here, I sort of went about it in the opposite order. I started with equivariant K-theory, and I extracted some geometry. But what I'd like to do now is reverse this construction, start with the geometry, and recover the equivariant cohomology. So this is data, say, sort of stated in a vague form. I'd like to make precise the kind of cohomology theory and the kind of geometry that I'm going to need in order to produce equivariant versions of that cohomology theory. Okay, so what sort of data am I going to need? Well, here I started with, version 1. We start with a multiplicative cohomology theory. And G is going to be some algebraic group defined over, well, in the case of K-theory, it was defined over Z. And the reason that Z came about was because Z was the K-theory, complex K-theory of a point. All right. So our first guess is that this is the sort of data that we should start out with. And now we want to construct, we want to build G equivariant versions of A. And our clue is that if we take the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point, motivated by what we saw in this example, the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point is supposed to recover the ring of functions on the group G. But now we immediately get stuck, because this here tells us how to define the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point, but the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point won't tell us how to compute the S1 equivariant cohomology of anything else. So this is a problem that has nothing to do with S1. If I just, in general, have a cohomology theory A, and I tell you the cohomology groups of a point, these are just the homotopy groups of A, where A is regarded as a spectrum, and a spectrum is not determined by its homotopy groups. You also have to know the K invariants, or how those homotopy groups are stuck together. So thinking about the A cohomology of a point is not going to be particularly informative if we view it just as, say, an abelian group or a commutative ring. But you can sort of define away this problem by interpreting the words A cohomology a little bit differently. That is, the A cohomology groups of X, as I mentioned last week, these are just the homotopy groups of a certain spectrum, namely the function spectrum A to the X. And so instead of talking about cohomology groups, I could talk about the cohomology spectrum, meaning the function spectrum A to the X. And now it's tautologically true that if I know the A cohomology of a point, then I know A, because the A cohomology of a point is just the same as A by definition. So the point is, this clue is not giving us enough information if we view it as an isomorphism of groups or an isomorphism of commutative rings. But it might give us enough information if we view it, if we elaborate it and consider a fancier version of this clue, which says that this should be an equivalent of some kind of spectra. But the right-hand side is, of course, a commutative ring. So if we want to incorporate that into our formalism as well, this should be an equivalent of some kind of spectra with a ring structure. And, well, we have such a notion, the notion of an E-infinity ring spectrum. And now if we want the right-hand side, which is the ring of functions on some algebraic group, to be an E-infinity ring spectrum, well, we probably shouldn't be interpreting algebraic group in the classical sense. Instead, we should be doing it in the sense of derived algebraic geometry, where our rings of functions are built out of E-infinity ring spectra. So all this was just to motivate version number 2, which is just going to be a fancier version of the same. So version 2, we're going to want to be doing algebraic geometry over E-infinity ring spectra rather than algebraic geometry over spec of the ordinary ring, the A cohomology of a point. So the first step is to assume that A is itself an E-infinity ring spectrum. So our data We're going to start with an E infinity ring spectrum, and we're going to start with G. This is going to be some sort of algebraic group. But algebraic group in the sense of derived algebraic geometry. Or it's defined over spec A rather than over any ordinary commutative ring. And now our clue is going to be that the S1 equivariant A cohomology of a point regarded as an E infinity ring spectrum should be equivalent to, well, the E infinity ring of functions on the algebraic group G. Okay, so yes, I will make it more precise in just a moment. So what do I mean? It's a good question. What do I mean by algebraic group here? So there's a couple of ways that I could define this. And I should specify. So one point of view on what a scheme is the one that I've been using so far, which is that a scheme is a topological space with a sheaf of rings such that dot, dot, dot. But another point of view is that a scheme is something which represents a functor. So what I'm going to mean by an algebraic group over spec A, so G, well, so first of all, G is going to be say a derived scheme with a map from G to spec A plus a group structure. So let's ignore the group structure for a moment and think about this in terms of the functor of points philosophy. So G defines a functor from A algebras to spaces, namely, that functor is given by B goes to the space of Homs from spec B into the group scheme G. So this is true if I were to take any derived scheme. Any derived scheme defined over A represents a functor from A algebras to spaces. Now, in classical algebraic geometry, if I wanted to say that a scheme had a group structure over spec A, then, well, in classical algebraic geometry, this would be a set-valued functor rather than a space-valued functor. And if I wanted to say that it had a group structure, I would say that it could be refined to a group-valued functor. That is, each of these Homs from spec B into G, the points of the functor G, have a natural group structure for every B. So, the group structure, and I should mention now that this is going to be a commutative algebraic group. So we have this functor from A algebras to spaces defined by G, and we want to refine this to spaces equipped with a commutative group structure. So here I'll write topological abelian groups and a group structure means a factorization of this functor. That is, instead of G being space valued, it's going to be valued in topological abelian groups. And let me just remark that there there's room for all kinds of variations on what I could put here. I could have put topological groups. Those are roughly spaces which would deloop once. I could have put infinite loop spaces here. That's another sort of homotopy theoretic analog of abelian group. But for purposes of building equivariant cohomology theories, it's going to be important that these actually be topological abelian groups. They'd be very, very commutative objects. Okay, so that's what I mean when I say that G has a commutative group structure, or it's a group scheme over spec A. Okay, so now this is the data that we're going to start with, and in fact we're going to need a little bit more data in a little bit, but we'll come to that when we come to it. And now what I would like to do is start trying to construct equivariant versions of the cohomology theory A. Okay, so step one of the construction is let T be a compact abelian Lie group. So, we'll notice here our clue is telling us what the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point is supposed to be as the ring of functions on some algebraic geometric object. I would like to generalize this clue, replacing S1 by a more general compact Lie group, but not too general. For the moment, let's stick to abelian groups. So I want some analog of this G, where S1 is more general here. So we're going to construct an A scheme, which I'm going to denote by G sub T. And now the definition is very simple. T is a compact abelian Lie group, so it has a Pontryagin dual, which is just the set of continuous homomorphisms from T to a circle, or in other words, the character group of T. So this is a finitely generated abelian group. And T and its dual determine each other because T is also the set of continuous homs, or now topologized, from T dual into the circle. So now, definition, G sub T, by definition, is going to be what I'll write as homs of abelian groups from T dual into G. So what I mean by that, I'm thinking of G as a functor which lands in topological abelian groups, and now I'm modifying that functor by thinking about homs from some other abelian group into that. And really, I guess I should say some kind of an R-hom here, but that's in the spirit that I mentioned earlier. Everything here is really carried out in the higher categorical or derived context. So the all homs really mean R-hom. So let me just give some examples. If G is S1, then G dual is just if T is S1, then T dual is just the integers, and if I hom the integers into T, I get G sub T is equal to G. If T is S1 cross S1, then T dual is Z cross Z, and I get G sub T, well, that's G cross G, but what do I mean by product here? This is product in the category of A scheme. So it's a fiber product over spec A. If T is the integers modulo N, then T dual is also the integers modulo N. And then I'm considering homs from the integers modulo N into G. In other words, the N torsion points on the group G. So G sub T in this case is the N torsion on G. Okay. So now, why did I introduce this G sub T? let me just make a remark. The ability to define G sub t as a functor of t, that's really tantamount to refining G and giving it a topological abelian group structure. Giving a topological abelian group structure is really the same data as giving this functor, which takes t to g of t. Okay, so now our motivation is going to be the following generalization of our clue. It's going to be that the t equivariant cohomology of a point is supposed to be the functions on G sub t. And this is supposed to be an equivalence of E infinity rings. Okay. So that's step one. We've constructed these things here. Okay. Step two. We want to make G sub t more functorial. So what do I mean by that? Well, G sub t, as it's defined, is manifestly a functor of t. But this clue suggests that this should be a little bit more functorial. Because the t equivariant A cohomology of a point, I should really think about this as the A cohomology of the orbifold given by a point modulo t. And therefore, it should only depend on that orbifold, a point modulo t. Now, if I give you that orbifold, well, it determines t as the automorphism groups of a point. But if we're talking really canonically, t is only determined once I fix a point to take the automorphisms up. So giving t is the same data as giving this orbifold plus a base point. And so the extra functoriality that I'm asking for is making this a functor of that orbifold without choosing a base point. So what do I want? Well, we want a functor instead of talking about the orbifold, let me talk about the classifying space BT. We want a functor that carries BT to this derived scheme G sub T. And we want it to be functorial for all maps between those classifying spaces and not just base point preserving maps. All right, so we know what we want the functor to do on objects. I've just told you. It's supposed to send the classifying space of T to this derived scheme G sub T. So now we have to get this extra functoriality, I have to say what it's going to do on morphisms. So let's consider two compact abelian Lie groups, T and T prime. What are all HOMs from BT to BT prime? So here I mean maps of spaces. So the space of maps from BT to BT prime, well, the first question you can ask about a map from BT to BT prime is where the base point goes. And BT prime, you can arrange that that has the structure of a group. So in fact, the space of all maps is a product of the space of base point preserving maps with BT prime, the set of places where the base point can go. So this looks like BT prime cross, say, base point preserving maps from BT to BT prime. And now base point preserving maps from BT to BT prime can be identified just with HOMs from T to T prime. And now we want this to map to the space of maps from GT to GT prime. And as I mentioned, this GT is already manifestly functorial in T. So we already know what we want to do on this factor, and really what we have to arrange is what we're going to do on this factor, BT prime. So let me rephrase. We want a map from BT prime to the space of maps from GT into GT prime. We want a map like this for every T and T prime, and moreover, we want these maps to be suitably functorial in T and T prime. Well, that sounds like a lot of data until we take into account the functoriality, but the functoriality immediately cuts it down quite a bit, because the left-hand side here is completely independent of T. So in order to provide such a map, which depends functorially in T, we only need to specify it in one universal case, namely the case where T is trivial. So functoriality in T reduces us to providing a map from VT prime into, well, now it's, we're in the case where T is trivial, and if T is trivial, GT is just spec A. Spec A into GT prime, or in other words, this is what I'll write as the A point of the A scheme GT prime, GT prime of A. Now, we also want this to be functorial in T prime. So functoriality in T prime lets us spell this out maybe a little more precisely. This reduces to a single universal example. The universal example in this case is the example where T prime is the circle group. And the data that we need to provide is a map from BT prime, that's the classifying space of the circle, or in other words, CP infinity, into Homs from spec A into GS1. Well, this is just the A points of the original algebraic group that we started with. And in order to build this for an arbitrary T prime, we need to have such a map, and we need to have this map be compatible with the abelian group structures on both sides. So this should be a map of topological abelian groups. And you can simplify this a little bit further if you take into account that CP infinity as a topological abelian group is really freely generated by the two-sphere. It's freely generated subject only to the relation that the base point of the two-sphere be the identity of the group. So this is the same thing. This is the same data as a map, now a map of pointed spaces from the two-sphere into the G points of A. And these are classified up to homotopy by the second homotopy group of G of A. All right, so the upshot of this discussion is that if we want to realize, if we want this formula to really, the left-hand side, we want this to be a functor only of this orbifold. If we want the right-hand side to have enough functoriality that this equality would make sense in that context, the additional data that we need to provide is precisely an element in pi 2 of G of A. So that's going to be part of our data. We're going to add the additional data of a pre-orientation. So a pre-orientation, by definition, is a pointed map from the two-sphere into the A points of the group G. Okay, so that was step two, construct this additional functoriality. To construct it, we needed a little bit more data. All right, now what are we going to do? All right, step three. So suppose that we have, say, a compact abelian Lie group acting on a space X. We want to construct A sub T of X. Now, just first, an observation. This we would expect to be a module over the A sub T cohomology of a point. And this is, by what I just erased, this is supposed to be the ring of functions. Or no, did I erase it? Probably. This is supposed to be the ring of functions on G sub T. So what we're looking for, we expect to be a module over the ring of functions on some derived scheme. Now, a good way to produce rings of functions, modules over rings, say, rings of functions, is to have A sub T of X be the global sections of some sheaf of modules on this same scheme, G sub T. So we're going to construct A sub T of it, of a space X. This is going to be the global sections of some F sub T of X, and F sub T of X is going to be a quasi-coherent sheaf on G sub T. So if G sub T was affine, then in fact, realizing A sub T of X as a module over this ring of functions is precisely the same thing as constructing it as the global sections of a quasi-coherent sheaf. If G sub T were not affine, which it won't be in the context of elliptic cohomology, this is a little bit better. This is saying that we sort of understand not only this data of F sub T is a little bit better than providing just its global sections. We don't expect on a non-affine scheme to be able to recover a quasi-coherent sheaf by thinking only about its global sections. So these F sub T's would be a little bit better than providing the cohomology functor T. Okay, so now let's write down some axioms for, these functors F sub T. So F sub T is going to be some functor from T spaces to quasi-coherent sheaves on G sub T. And we should think of it as some sort of a primordial version of A T equivariant A cohomology. So axiom number one, this is going to be like cohomology, so this is going to be a contravariant functor. So axiom number one is what you might call excision or Meyer-Viatoris. Stated in this form, in this context, what we should say is that F sub T carries homotopy colimits to homotopy limits. In other words, if you have a space with T space which is made up of some complicated parts, then we expect that there's some sort of recipe for understanding the cohomology of the entire space in terms of the cohomology of the parts. Axiom number two is a change of T axiom. Let's suppose that we have T acting on some space X, and we also have T embedded in T prime, then we can induce this T space up to make a T prime space. Namely, we can define X prime to be X cross T prime modulo a diagonal action of T, and now X prime is equipped with an action of T prime. So all of these functors F sub T are supposed to be related. So this map from T to T prime induces a map from G sub t to G sub t prime. Let me call this eta. And axiom number two, what we want to say is that the t equivariant cohomology of x should be the same thing as the t prime equivariant cohomology of x prime. So f sub t of x and f sub t prime of x prime should be related somehow. But we can't say that these are the same because they're quasi-coherent sheaves which live on different spaces. F sub t of x lives on g sub t, f sub t prime of x prime lives on g of t prime. So what we can say instead is that if we push forward along this map, eta, that these two things should be the same. And therefore, they'll have the same global sections. And remember that taking the global sections of these sheaves is how we get cohomology. And now, I don't want to erase our data. Axiom number three is some kind of normalization. So one way to satisfy axioms 1 and 2, of course, is to have f sub t be everywhere 0. But that's not what we want. Let's require that f sub t of a point be the structure sheaf of g sub t. Because remember, g sub t was supposed to be arranged that if we take the global sections of its structure sheaf, we get the equivariant cohomology of a point. Okay, so these are our three axioms for how these functors f sub t should behave. And now I'd like to argue that there's an essentially unique way to satisfy these axioms. That is, suppose that we know that these three properties should be satisfied, and suppose I have t acting on some space x, and we want to compute f sub t of x. Well, the first, what axiom 1 lets us do is break x up into pieces. So in order to it lets us reduce computing f sub t of x to the case where x is in some sense atomic or as small as possible. So using 1, f sub t of x is determined by f sub t of more simpler t spaces, namely t spaces which are just orbits of t. So t spaces which look like t modulo t prime, where t prime is some subgroup of t. And now axiom number two tells us that f sub t of t modulo t prime should be the same as some push forward of f sub t prime of a point, because t modulo t prime, but here the roles of t and t prime have been switched for comparison with this board, but t modulo t prime, that's the t space that we get by taking t prime acting on a point and inducing up to t. And finally, axiom number three tells us what f sub t prime of a point is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the structure sheaf of O of t prime. So this is sort of an informal argument, but if you were to formulate these axioms more precisely, then you can actually turn this into an actual proof that there's a unique functor which satisfies these axioms. Well, I would be working in a context where commuting on the nose is not even a well-defined question. Like, this would all be, say, formulated in some... Yes. So I'm not sure if this is going to answer your question, but there's a remark that I was about to make which might. So in order to turn this into a proof, of course, you have to make sure that you have sort of everything that you're doing is completely canonical. And in this proof that I described, there was one very non-canonical step. And that was f sub t of x was determined by what it did on t orbits. And every t orbit looks like t modulo t prime. But that's you can only canonically identify it with T modulo T prime once you've chosen a base point. And so this creates some ambiguity in the application of these axioms, but this ambiguity is precisely accounted for by the extra functoriality which I required at step two. That is, F sub t of t mod t prime, we can identify that with sort of f of the orbifold that I get by dividing out t mod t prime by t. So that orbifold is a copy of bt prime, but it doesn't have a canonical base point. But what I told you during step two was that we didn't actually need a canonical base point in order to define g sub t prime and its sheaf of functions. So that extra functoriality, which in our data comes from this class here, is exactly what we need in order to make this construction base point independent. All right, so that is where I would have stopped because I'm out of time. I'm not sure if that answered your question. If not, ask it again. Well, that's just another way of spelling out this sort of data. Uh-huh. I mean, you could sort of define whatever it is that you want in many different ways, and then if you try and sort of relate it to something more concrete, then you find out it's a group structure plus this. Classifying. Well, if t is not discrete, is that? Well, so I guess I should mention here that here I only treated the case where t is abelian. There is a natural way to extend this to non-abelian groups, which maybe I can talk about at the beginning next time. I guess that's not addressing your question. I'm not sure what...